I'm Lissy Friedman. I'm a senior staff attorney at the Public Health Advocacy Institute at Northeastern University School of Law in Boston. And I'm going to be talking to you today about the tobacco industry's use of personal responsibility messaging. I have no financial relationships to disclose. So our study methodology is fairly typical of one that looks at the tobacco industry's documents, internal documents that are posted online. Oops. And but in addition to looking at their internal documents, we also looked at trial transcripts and legal memos and things like that. I'd also like to acknowledge our study partners, Berkeley Media Studies Group. Andrew Shane is here with us today. His group did an additional element to our study, which was to do a content analysis of press statements in newspapers. And I also added my bit, which was to analyze the press clips that the tobacco industry had actually retained in their own files. So that included not only newspapers, but radio and television, and speeches to their constituents in Congress, et cetera. So when we started the project, our aim of the project was to look at the tobacco industry's use of personal responsibility rhetoric. And we were very surprised, especially going into the tobacco documents, to find that they don't actually generally use that explicit expression. The tobacco industry is very good at using euphemisms and other ways to talk about things in a much more effective way. And while they use personal responsibility rhetoric to protect their interests against regulation and litigation and to shift focus away from their role as a disease vector, it's the second part which leads me to believe that they don't use actual personal responsibility, the words, because then that would also redound to them. What about corporate responsibility? So, as is their wont, they decided instead to use a diversionary tactic, which is to focus the public's attention not on the cascading scientific evidence that was coming in that smoking is harmful and deadly, and to try to invoke themes that were more appealing to the general public. So this is a quote from a 1979 internal memo. It is important to remember that health or scientific arguments can be ineffective in communicating with the general public. On the other hand, most people can clearly identify with arguments based on freedom of choice, and many people feel strongly that the hand of government should not interfere with their private life. So, you know, basically it's the old sleight of hand. Let's not talk about the science over here, let's talk about, platitudes, freedom of choice. And it kind of reminds me of that expression, if you can't, you know, dazzle them with brilliance, you baffle them with bullshit. So the messaging war, basically on the PR front, and by PR what I mean is when they're talking to the press or in public in any way, was to invoke this idea of liberty, to try to garner support from Americans' natural tendency to support of liberty and freedom. And they said there's a large constituency may already exist for a program that promotes freedom of choice and individual rights. Within such a program, the cigarette industry side of the story might best be told. So again, it's playing on American rugged individualism. But in reality, of course, their real aim was to stave off regulation and avoid blame and litigation. And another internal memo said their strategy was to develop counter-propaganda to more effectively neutralize and diminish the influence of the anti-smoking organizations, to support personal freedom of choice for smokers, and to enhance the credibility of the scientific controversy. So this is really not about freedom. It's about producing and selling cigarettes and the freedom to smoke. So, like I said, we really didn't find the words personal responsibility much, either in the internal documents, their public statements, or in the legal transcripts that we read. Mostly what we found was the expression freedom of choice. And the tobacco industry is very clever in using, well, they think they're clever in using euphemisms. So for instance, they don't talk about the addictive nature of nicotine, they talk about impact. So that kind of gives you an idea of what I'm talking about. And when they talk about freedom of choice, something that our study picked up on was a subtlety between the meanings that they infuse in that expression. So depending on whether you're talking about the PR context or the litigation context, you're going to get a completely different meaning. And my partners at the Berkeley Media Studies Group have taught me now how important it is to perceive how an issue is framed, because if you can figure that out, you can figure out a much more efficacious response. So in the broader PR context, generally when they say freedom of choice, what they mean is liberty. When they talk about freedom of choice, they're talking about the American way, and you know, let's get government off our back and let's let people smoke if they want to. And so choice is something that's good. Smokers have a right to smoke free from intervention and regulation to discourage consumption. Of course, the reality is that when you sell a highly addictive product and you market it deceptively, that removes freedom and liberty from the equation. In the litigation context, we found that when they talked about freedom of choice, they were actually talking about choice as blame, by which I mean when a plaintiff sues the tobacco company for their injuries, the tobacco defendants would say, well, you chose to smoke, and therefore you're solely to blame for your own injuries. So in that context, the industry frame is choice equals blame, whereas in the PR context, it's choice equals liberty. And of course, the reality in this instance is that smokers generally start smoking when they're children. They're marketed to ruthlessly, and the tobacco industry has lied about the addictive and harmful nature of its products. And of course, they're not wholly to blame for their injury, as we're seeing now in the Florida litigation, where we're doing about 75% in favor of the plaintiffs. So what I'm trying to do with this presentation is to help you train your ear to perceive the difference between the two kinds of arguments. That's sort of what content analysis is about, and that's what we have to be good at. My colleague Ruth Malone yesterday was talking about how we need to be as clever as the tobacco industry thinks we are in terms of opposing them. So this is from a 1976 PR communications memo, and I just want you to train your ear. Freedom of choice is an American birthright. Infringement of this right is an injustice. Freedom of choice is the essential premise of American democracy. We recognize that to make a proper choice, there should be full disclosure of all pertinent facts, but nobody should be denied the freedom to make informed choices. How many times can we say freedom and choice in one little bite? Okay, here is an example of the choice as blame rhetoric. This is from a 1985 smokers case. And the cigarette attorney's attorney asked the plaintiff's expert, the decision to smoke is one which is a matter of free choice. And if you exercise that free choice to smoke, then it's important that you take personal responsibility for that decision, isn't it? So that's quite a contrast to when they were invoking, you know, these American ideals of freedom and, you know, sort of wrapping themselves in the flag. Now they're saying, well, hey, that's not our problem. You made the choice. So because I'm a lawyer, I'm going to talk just a tiny bit about some legal concepts that I noticed were also influencing the larger PR message. And when we were studying the tobacco litigation documents, we noticed that, you know, in any sort of a court case, somebody's suing somebody else, and there's going to be blame apportioned. You know, it's either the person who brought the suit against the defendant is either the defense is to blame, or maybe the plaintiff is to blame. So, generally, when a plaintiff proves their case, they should win. But there's this thing called an affirmative defense, which means that if the defendant can prove that the plaintiff did something also that overrides the defense's responsibility, then they can't recover damages. So the tobacco industry uses these defenses to blame their customers for their injury. So there are a couple of different kind of affirmative defenses that the tobacco industry uses. One is called assumption of the risk. And basically what that is they say, you, Mr. Plaintiff, you knew that smoking was risky and therefore you should not be able to recover for damages. The other kind of affirmative defense that they like to use is called common knowledge, where instead of saying, you, Mr. Plaintiff, you knew, they say, everybody knows. Everybody knows this is a dangerous activity. It's risky. We've got the Surgeon General's report. We've got all these media stories about it and all these public health people telling you it was bad. And so it was obvious that you took a chance and you should not recover for your injuries. We found some wonderful documents in the database. They were training manuals that the lawyers wrote for each other to help really elucidate how they were going to use these tactics as a hammer against the plaintiff to shift the blame back to the plaintiff and away from their product. And the manual said, how best to blunt the plaintiff's anticipated attacks on corporate conduct while keeping the focus of each case on the particular plaintiff and his choices is the fundamental tactical problem posed by this litigation. So they know more is at stake than just this one case. And up until the 90s, they had never lost a case. So they have to keep the focus back on the person, away from the corporation. So the training manual in talking about the common knowledge defense, the everybody knows defense, this is, of course, another one of the fine lines so evident in this case. We must show the history of dire warnings without appearing to indict the industry for selling poison. So they know they're like the ugliest person in the dance and nobody wants to dance with them, but if they have like a really cool ride outside, maybe. So here's some trial testimony using this assumption of the risk of events. And again, try to remember what I was talking about, either, you know, freedom of choice equals liberty, freedom of choice equals blame. This is from a 1988 trial. This is their opening statement. Now, what the evidence will show is that Mrs. Cipollone smoked because she enjoyed smoking. It gave her a great deal of pleasure. She liked it. Now, Rose Cipollone made that choice for herself. She did what she wanted to do. So they're saying, you, Mrs. Cipollone, you knew. All right, here's how they use the everybody knows defense in trial. They said, the public has been warned and overwarned for decades. And the research that I have seen also tells me that people know the accusations against cigarettes far better than they know the national motto, or in fact anything else in society, that people feel that they have been warned and very heavily so for decades. Does anybody know what the national motto is? I don't. Okay. So basically, you know, what they're doing is this sort of tactical jiu-jitsu that was very effective in the courtroom. It occurred to them this could be very effective also in the court of public opinion. And so these lawyerly tactics, which in the a panel previously that I attended this morning, they talked about how the lawyers were, you know, it's embarrassing to me. I feel like I'm doing penance for, you know, my fellow lawyers. A lot of times it was the lawyers who really informed the strategy. So the choices blame rhetoric started leaking into their general public relations message, and again trying to shift the responsibility from the companies to the victims. So here's a PR message starting to infuse that everybody knows common knowledge. There's not a citizen in this country or anywhere else, I believe, today in the world that has not heard the message warning the Surgeon General has determined. Anyone would have to have been a cave dweller not to have gotten the message today. So that was the Tobacco Institute spokesperson in a radio interview. Try to compare that back to, you know, what they were talking about with, you know, everybody knows that smoking's bad for you. So, of course, you're going to do it. here's an assumption of the risk PR message. This was Walker Merriman, he's the president of the Tobacco Institute, in a newspaper article. He says, people have made a free choice, which includes the right to take risks and evaluate the degree of those risks. So, you know, individually, each smoker makes that choice. And again, also blending in the choice as freedom. So it's very subtle, but it worked for a long time. So anybody who has attended one of my talks before knows that at this point I'm going to talk about denormalization. And I talk about it a lot because it really all comes down to that. It's about what our efforts to combat this have to boil down to is denormalizing not just the product, but the corporate activity. This is, as other speakers at the conference have said, this is corporation versus the public health. It's not, you know, it's not tobacco, it's not cigarettes, it's the corporations. And so what we need to do is to undermine their efforts at garnering corporate social responsibility that my colleagues have talked about. And we need to call them out because studies have shown that this helps generate support for tobacco control measures and interventions. It helps people who want to quit to get motivated to quit. It also helps prevent people from smoking. And it galvanizes us as a force to say we're not going to allow corporations to poison our public health. So, and this has applications not just to tobacco. I attended a wonderful session yesterday where they had someone from alcohol justice, and they had a person talking about prescription drugs and another person talking about tobacco. You know, this is an issue that can apply to any product that causes a public health challenge, be it junk food, alcohol, guns, what have you. And the key to our being effective advocates and warriors against the tobacco industry, or as Ruth Malone called it yesterday, the anti-tobacco industry. That's what apparently the tobacco industry calls us. We're the anti-tobacco industry. Is to be more sophisticated in how we respond, how we frame our own arguments, and how we, you know, dance with the devil. You know, you have to be just as clever, or you're going to get your foot stepped on. So, thank you.
Thank you to the wonderful teams and presenters for nurturing us with information. And I mean, I think that one more either hooting and hollering or round of applause is necessary right here. Thank you so much. Okay, so we have ample time for questions, which is a wonderful thing. I'll ask questioners to limit to one question. I think a bit of a comment in context is fine before the question, direct it to whom you would like or to any of the panelists, and I would ask the panelists to repeat the question so all can hear, and there's an audio tape as well, so people will know the question and answer well into the future. Thank you very much.
Warning labels, and we have a paper coming out in Tobacco Control where we actually found the industry's lawyers' advice on exactly that point. And they were consistently told in three different countries that that argument does not hold water, that while governments have a responsibility to protect the company's trademark from infringement by competitors, the governments have the complete right to restrict the company's use of their own trademark. So I just wanted to, because that's an issue that's taken great currency in the debate on it, and the companies, as I said, they went to three different countries' lawyers, and they all told them that the argument that you quoted in there was actually wrong.
And thank you, Sam, for bringing that up, because there's a lot to cover in the...
Yeah, no, I'm not criticizing you, I'm just amplifying.
Yeah, no, I appreciate that. Thank you.
This is a question about the filters. I've heard, and tell me if I misheard, that the filters are not just as dangerous as with no filters, but they're even more dangerous, because I heard that when people inhale deeper, the kind of lung cancer people are getting is more deadly than it was with no filters. Is that?
Yeah, so there are just actually several arguments saying that filters are more dangerous than non-filters. That is one of them. People who believe that they're being safer, so they kind of inhale more deeply and they suck harder, and that brings it deeper. And the type of lung cancer is switched from adenocarcinoma. Pulmonologists in the room can correct me. That's one thing that people have said. I haven't looked into that topic so much, so I don't really feel comfortable saying explicitly that, but from my documents research, I know that there are several different things that have come up that say that filters are in fact more dangerous. Another one is Bill Ferrone has testified that the ventilation holes, it's another thing that they've done, is they literally poked holes in the side of the cigarette, and that sucks oxygen in right above the filter. So that's right where the finger covers the hole. So in some cases, the holes are sort of ineffective because the finger covers them, but Ferrone has testified that the oxygen coming in right there changes the combustion and pyrolysis reactions going on in the rod of the cigarette, and in fact creates more carcinogens at that point in the cigarette, just as the smoker is inhaling, than otherwise would be the case without ventilation holes. So any time that they change the way the cigarette is manufactured, things down the line are changing ways that they perhaps didn't imagine, or anybody imagines, because it's such a complex situation. That's what we're trying to stress, is that, as Robert said earlier, that it's about the process of making the cigarettes and not necessarily about single ingredients. It's about the whole package.
Here and here.
To the point about calling out industry interference, the U.S. has been ratified the Global Tobacco Treaty, which includes Article 5.3 that protects against industry interference. So if we were to do that, how would that help us?
Were you directing that?
Yeah, sorry.
The question is, in combating industry interference, how would we use the as-yet-to-be-ratified Framework Convention on Tobacco? And I will say, quite honestly, I'm not qualified to answer the question, but my boss is. And I think he'll come up here and talk, Professor Richard Daynard. Would you mind coming up and saying just a quick word on that?
Well, I don't think I need to come up.
Could you use the microphone?
Oh, sure. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah,
thanks.
The relevant article in the Framework Convention is Article 5.3, and Corporate Accountability International has actually taken the lead. They're in Boston, but a very international, in fact, a group, and they've actually taken the lead both in getting very strong guidelines under 5.3. The actual practical effect of the U.S. adopting the Framework Convention is not totally clear. In other words, we have a couple of people that's well known on this TPSAC, this tobacco, this scientific advisory board for the FDA, and they are non-voting members. There's been a lot of discussion at this meeting about the FDA not taking effective action, at least to date. I don't think these two members on TPSAC are the reason.
Members of the tobacco industry.
The what?
Members of the
tobacco industry. Sorry, thank you. Yeah, exactly. Two members of the tobacco industry. But they're... So in those countries that are trying to implement Section 5.3, I think the effect has varied from country to country. There are 174 or 5 countries that have ratified the Framework Convention. I assure you that in many, if not most, of these countries, the tobacco industry continues to have a major effect on government policy. But what it does is it gives the NGOs and people in the health ministries there an argument to make and sometimes it makes a positive contribution. So, I don't think anybody should imagine that if we were to ratify this convention that there would be, a sea change, that, everything would change automatically. It simply provides another level of argumentation, another thing that a conscientious government administrator would look at. Now I can ask my question, or make my point. This was about the package labeling with these wonderful crests. And when I look at them, I always thought that this is in Britain, that these are under royal patronage. Because the very similar crests are used to signify royal patronage. And I didn't hear that reference, but I would have thought that this was essentially a fraudulent attempt to suggest that there's some kind of, royal patronage, or something the equivalent, depending on the country, for these cigarettes.
So that's a really interesting point that you raised, and it's actually one that came up in our focus group research. A lot of the youth mentioned, well, that just looks just like the royals, and there is, from what I know, there's no association between the royal family anymore and tobacco products. But at one point, we're talking in the 1900s, there was a line that was developed specifically for a member of the royal family. I can't remember which one it is right now, but the information says there.
I see 1, 2, 3, and 4.
Lucy, I just wanted to thank you for your presentation. I have been wanting to do a study of Detroit forever and how they talk about it. And I think this is maybe more of a comment. With Ashton Sanders Jackson and folks at UC San Francisco, we've just been looking at smokers, focus groups, and coding, how they talk about smoking. And this freedom of choice comes up quite a lot. So it's been taken on as well. From the standpoint of it being about liberty. And then I also worked in lung cancer stigma, and I just thought it was interesting that the blame side of the freedom of choice seems to be what fuels lung cancer stigma. Through the blame of your smoker, therefore, it's your fault that you got lung cancer. So I'm really grateful for your
thank you. The commenter was talking about how smokers kind of get it going both ways. The cigarette industry dupes them into thinking they're making a free choice, which they started when they were probably below the age of 18, when their cognitive decision-making capabilities in their brain aren't even finished forming. And then, when they're addicted, later in life, they feel stigmatized because the tobacco industry had promised them that nothing bad would happen to them when they smoked. when they turn around and say, "Yeah, but I got sick, and I think you should do something about this." And I mean, well, you're to blame. I always thought it really strange that the tobacco industry would say, in the litigation context, they say, they get the plaintiff up on the stage if they're lucky enough that the plaintiff is still alive, and they'll say, "Now you, Mr. Smoker, I want you to listen to me," this is the attorney, and say, "We have put the most sophisticated scientists on this problem, and there is no proof that there's a causation between smoking and X disease. However, you, Mr. Plaintiff, who probably started smoking when you were 14 and weren't thinking about mortality or morbidity, you should have known, because everybody knows that smoking's bad for you." So, and furthermore, all that stuff we told you about how there's no proof that smoking causes lung cancer, well, sorry, you lost. So it's really a shame game all around. They reel them in, and then they cast them off. And, I really struggled when we started research program, because we really couldn't find explicit use of that expression, personal responsibility. And then I started thinking about it, and I realized
well, there's probably something else that they're saying instead. That's the way they operate. And then I started getting confused because some of the things I found were talking about these soaring principles of freedom. And some of the things I looked at were saying, you know, you should have known that you were hurting yourself with these problems. It's not our problem. And then I realized it was slotting itself into two piles, choice and blame. So that's sort of the evolution of the product. I'm glad there's somebody else out there who thinks that sounds kind of right.
Our next question.
I'm Dr. Joel Litzkin. I'm a public health physician. By way of disclaimer, I've never received any support from any tobacco industry or pharmaceutical source. I would like to point out how use of language can and does distort public health action and responses, and they actually do some harm. And this was demonstrated very clearly by every single one of our panelists today. And the distortion I'm talking about is using the terms cigarette and tobacco synonymously. This has been done for decades in the tobacco control movement and has left many people with the erroneous impression that all tobacco products are equally harmful and anything having to do with tobacco should therefore be eliminated from American society. The science is incontrovertible that there are a wide range of smoke-free tobacco products that present a risk of tobacco-attributable illness and death less than 2% the risk posed by cigarettes. Now, this distortion in language, and I'd like a panel response to it, has created what may be a severely harmful situation in the context of the FDA legislation in response to it. Basically, what the FDA legislation is leading us to is grandfathering in all of the currently marketed cigarette products.
Questions, please. We have two more questions, and so we'll need yours, please.
Very, very quickly. While using everything in their power to suppress the introduction of the smoke-free product and prevent them from communicating to the public that people could reduce their risk by switching to a lower risk product. Is this a problem induced by our use of language?
Perhaps. Point taken.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you very much. We had two last questions, please.
So I was interested with the tobacco packaging. When you showed the Australian packaging, plain packaging, you used the disclaimer as the base of the value of it. And I'd be interested to find out from that book what the value of it.
From my perspective, it is not debatable, and that's my own personal opinion, that it would be something that, you know, I would advocate for in the introduction of plain and standard tax. But again, that's my own personal opinion. It's a matter, there's been a lot of debate both from the tobacco industry and from different bodies in the news recently, and that's all I meant to raise with that.
I'm so sorry, it went like a flash, so please.
I just have a quick question for Emily. So Lucy and I co-authored a paper over the summer that looked at the history of corporate social responsibility, more like the youth smoking programs, but then also comparing it to contemporary marketing by the soda industry and looking at their expressed use of CSR as a way to reach youth. And I was just curious, either in your focus groups or in the tobacco industry documents, if there's evidence for these contemporary tobacco CSR strategies of the youth outreach.
It's not something that I looked for specifically, or that my team did. It would be a really interesting search to do. We did do an examination that looked specifically at youthfulness that was connoted by cigarette packages, and we also looked at little cigars and cigarillos, and particularly the similarities between the packaging of youthful products such as the Great Revive gum and tobacco products.
So I see your question. Anybody else to get in? Okay, so we'll end with this question, but panelists will be here for the last few minutes, and we can continue the discussion until then.
Thanks. I just wanted to commend the panel for a wonderful session. And but I wanted to ask the first presenter about the last part of her presentation, about the role of the future. How could you say, explain a little more what you say and go a little farther?
The question is about the last part of my presentation and talking about the future. I assume you're talking about the end game discussion. There are lots of people here that can talk in much more with much more knowledge about it than I can, but there are many different proposals out there about ways to shut down the tobacco industry in various forms, and one of them that I mentioned was trying to transform the tobacco industry from a profit-making industry to a not-for-profit, and that would involve perhaps in Canada there was a proposal to have a government purchase some large tobacco company that was being sold and turn it into a non-profit and have the agenda change from trying to reduce sales rather than to promote sales. So that's just one option. There are many options out there. Robert Proctor, who's sitting right here in front, has also talked about changing the requirements so that the pH level is raised to a certain level to make a tobacco product or cigarettes less mild and more difficult to smoke, reducing the amount of nicotine to make the products less addictive. So there are lots of different options out there.
I have the benefit of having just attended a lecture that answers this question. So, another thing that Dr. Proctor has mentioned is it's apparently completely legal to ban the sale of tobacco in any town, cigarettes, tobacco, in any town or locality in the United States. And if you got a critical mass of folks who were doing that, you know, you might, if you didn't succeed ultimately, because of political pressure, you would certainly garner support for the measure from the public. We at the Public Health Advocacy Institute are also collaborating with other advocates to look at pressuring the FDA to use the power that it has in its regulatory power to lower the level of nicotine to unaddictive levels in cigarettes. By statute, they're not allowed to completely eliminate it, but they're certainly allowed to lower it, and that would piggyback with Professor Proctor's suggestion to make the pH higher and the cigarette harsher, and at the same time make the nicotine level lower, which would make it less addictive. So, anybody else? Yes, Professor
Dan. I just say, there's one additional very attractive proposal that was made by professors in Singapore, but under consideration in Tasmania, and that's the smoke-free generation. To say that you can't sell cigarettes to anybody, that is most easily understood as the smoke-free millennial generation. You can't sell cigarettes to anybody who was born after the year 2000 or more recently. So anybody who wanted his or her ID card starts with a 2, you can't sell cigarettes to them. It has a great advantage that if you're talking about peer pressure, you know, there's no peer pressure. And at some point, while you will still have older people smoking cigarettes, they will begin to look like old fogies, you know, who are really not with it. And there'll be additional social pressure on them to quit rather than on to keep smoking. So I think that's another proposal that should be taken very seriously. I think it has a lot of political and other appeal.
So that was the last word, and we've all enjoyed a healthy California workout, especially our panelists. So thank you, and wishing you a healthy and happy APHA as it continues, and continued lifelong learning in our learning community together.
Thank you.
thank everyone, and I'm sure the panelists are here and happy to chat and connect and network. Thank you.